Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. Fox News apologizes again for using the wrong footage. Not for the same wrong footage, different wrong footage. For the second week in a row, new unemployment claims are the lowest in a year. On the other hand, the index of leading economic indicators went up, but not by as much as expected. As part of the mechanism for financing the health insurance reform law now being offered in the Senate, one suggestion was to place a 5% government levy on cosmetic surgery. Could this be a Botox? Former Illinois governor wants to get part of his pension restored, despite being convicted of corruption in office. Good luck, George. Oprah will be leaving her talk show in 2011. Can 2012 be far behind? The University of California raises tuition by nearly a third due to that state's budget cuts. Nothing like raising fees during a recession. Nice going, guys. Don't drive drunk with a child in your vehicle in New York. It's a felony. Beginning next year, you're going to have a choice of operating systems for your computer. Windows, Apple's operating system, Linux, or Chrome? Yeah, Chrome. The subject of our endpoint essay tonight is, I'd walk a million miles for one of your smiles, my mammogram. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That'll be me. Yes, those subjects and more, including an interview with our special guest, James Bailey, who's going to give us a new spin on the concept of family values. And we'll be talking about his book called Bailey's Blood, Moonshine, Murder, and Wild Women. And along with publishing and his recent book tour. And if you're in Kentucky, you might want to pay special attention. And again, a promise that if there's time, we'll talk about oregano oil and acne. And we also have weird news. But first, whether you have one or more kids in your home, I'll bet you have at least one child who lives with you. They're called pets. If you have a pet you know, then that your companion animal or animals are really your children. And that's how we all treat them. If you feel about your pet children the way my wife and I do, you want them to have the best food, best shampoo and other grooming products, the most enjoyable and safe toys, real meat bones, and the best of everything they need or want. But you also want it to be available for a reasonable price. I've got the answer, as you might have guessed. Pet Lane provides all of the above, great products at very reasonable prices, and you don't even have to leave the house to get them. You can just go to petlane.com/Bushman. That's B-U-S-H-M-A-N. And you'll find the products that we're talking about and much, much more. You deserve to be able to indulge your pets. Now you can. Petlane.com/Bushman. Returning to our happy episode, I wanted to talk first about the television network belonging to the Republican National Committee. It doesn't? Oh, okay. Fox News, which might as well. You may remember hearing, or perhaps you didn't hear, that a bit over a week ago, they incorrectly showed tape on the Sean Vanity Show from an earlier rally with a large crowd that was supposed to be footage of a Michelle Bachmann teabag rally. Michelle Bachmann, for those who don't know, is a congressional representative from the state of Minnesota, who is thought by many people to be a nutcase. But in any event, she held a rally, and they showed footage of the crowds, and they accidentally showed a rally that had a much larger crowd, along with the Michelle Bachmann story. Well, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show happened to feature on his show the fact that they had done that. He had caught it. And the next day, Sean apologized on his show and admitted that they had used the wrong footage, said it was a mistake, not on purpose, and they were sorry. Okay. Well, now, yesterday, they used footage of a McCain-Palin rally that had occurred during the 2008 presidential election campaign, intended, apparently, to be showing crowds that were coming out to see the lady who might be called the former future vice president, Sarah Palin, on her book signing tour. Today they said they didn't mean to mislead anyone. Of course they didn't. And they did acknowledge that they had made a mistake. In reading the story today, someone in the blogosphere suggested that tomorrow on Fox, they're going to show video of Nazi tanks streaming through North Africa and label it as Obama attacking Oklahoma. Unfortunately, I didn't think of that, but undoubtedly someone at Fox is working on it as we speak. We spoke at the front about the economic situation. As soon as you have people referring to what's going on as an economic situation, you know there's a problem. But and, of course, we've had a problem for a long time. But unemployment claims, first-time jobless claims, that is, are down again. The second week in a row, they're the lowest in a year. And the leading economic indicators went up, and as said, not by as much as was anticipated by most economists, they only went up 0.3%. We need to just spend a moment, we do this frequently on the show, talking about economic indicators and what they mean. First, leading economic indicators are things like, among other things, like stock market indexes and factory orders for durable goods, like, you know, refrigerators, cars, so forth. The leading economic indicators are believed to indicate what's going to happen in the future in the economy. A lagging economic indicator is something that occurs in terms of a statistic, but it goes after the economy has either recovered or declined. So if unemployment has gone up after a lot of other things have gone badly with the economy, it is also likely to go down after the economy has recovered. Employment is always a lagging indicator. It always changes after the rest of the economy has taken direction. So you'll see unemployment continue to be fairly high, even if it reduces, after, after the recovery is fully in place. So that's what's occurring. Now, the leading economic indicators are going up, indicating that the future, the near-term future in the economy is likely to be good, but there is concern, and this may be why the Dow Jones Industrial Average went down today, there's concern that because they didn't go up as much as was expected, it might mean a slower recovery for the economy. So that's what that is. The former governor of Illinois is named George Ryan. George Ryan will forever have a place in my heart for something he did with regard to capital punishment. But the former Republican governor of Illinois is now in jail. He's in a federal prison. I think they call it a penitentiary, actually, if it's federal. But anyway, he's in a penitentiary serving time for corruption in office. He was convicted of doing a number of things. Among them was granting driver's licenses, I believe it was, for money, without whether or not someone had adequate identification. This is all before the terrorism concerns, but that's one of the things he was convicted of doing, if memory serves. I'm sure I'll be corrected on that by a friend of mine who's a former Illinois resident. But he was convicted for the crimes he committed when he was Secretary of State and when he was governor. He also served as lieutenant governor, and he's seeking to have that portion of his pension restored. I would assume that if that in fact occurs, if the powers that be in Illinois actually grant that, there's going to be some real political, what's the word I'm looking for, damage to be paid by those people who vote in favor of it or make a decision to grant him that pension. Governor Ryan is not all bad. Before he left office, and he wasn't kicked out, incidentally, he finished his term, but before he left office, he pardoned a number of people who had been wrongly convicted, and he changed the sentences of a number of people on death row to life without possibility of parole, and granted some people new trials when there was evidence to indicate they had been convicted unjustly. And it was a risk for him of sorts, or maybe he just wanted to have positive press with people who would be deciding his fate later. But whatever the reason, he did a wonderful job, and he is going to be remembered as a pioneer who, once we end this horrible death penalty situation we have in the United States, will be looked at as a pioneer in that struggle. The University of California today raised tuition by a 32% actually. When I attended the University of California about 3 million years ago, they actually didn't have anything they called tuition. They had what they called an incidental fee, which presumably allowed you to participate in several incidents per year. But even then, the cost of college was realized to be extremely inexpensive if you went to the University of California, any of the campuses. And to put it in those dollars, in those days, it was, I believe, $106 or $107 per quarter, and you typically attended three quarters per year. So your total, call it tuition, was less than $325 a year. I don't know what it is now, but whatever it is, when you raise those fees by about a third, you're going to have certain people who are attending the university who have no choice but to drop out. Some will get additional jobs. Some will hopefully get better jobs. Some will seek loans, but loans are becoming less available, and some people will be dropping out of the university. This is a denial of the promise to middle-class people that if you go through school and you work hard and do all the things you're supposed to do, at the very least you can get a university education and succeed in life, possibly. And there are a number of people now to whom that opportunity will be denied. New York passed a law that said if you're driving and there's a child in your vehicle and you're drunk, you're stopped and you're drunk, it's a felony. A felony is a crime that's punishable by a year or more in prison and a fine of $1,000 or more in most states. There are slightly different definitions in other states. For certain what it is in New York, but it is a felony. It's obviously considered a very serious crime, and it is serious. It's obviously a terrible thing to drive drunk at all, and with a child in your vehicle, it's clearly irresponsible, even more irresponsible than if you don't. Now it's a felony, and if you get convicted of that felony, you will have to have installed in your vehicle at your expense a device that will require you to blow into what amounts to a breathalyzer before you can start your vehicle. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think it's probably a good thing. But I wanted to mention it because it talks to us, or at least to me, about the issue of crime and punishment. And before we get into that further, let me give you the phone number in case you'd like to call and join in, either now or when our guest joins us. The phone number is area code 347-994-3796. Unless you happen to be in that area code, it's going to be long distance for you, so I will try to get you on fairly quickly should you call. I know many, many people have free long distance now, but in the event you don't, you can rest assured you won't be on hold for a long time. Getting back to crime and punishment. First, talking about drunk driving. One of the concepts behind punishments for drunk driving is that if they're severe, you will not commit the act. The only problem with that is that's a logical connection. And when someone's drunk, I'm not sure they can make it. I've never been drunk myself, but for those of you who are drunk, no, seriously, for those who have been drunk, you probably know better than I do that being drunk affects your ability to make judgments. If it affects your ability to make judgments, how are you going to choose whether to get into the car after you've had too much to drink? Clearly, at the beginning of the night, you can make a decision not to drink if you know you're going to drive. That would be perfectly sensible. But many people can take one drink in an evening and still drive. Their blood alcohol level will be below the requisite amount to be considered drunk or impaired. And yet, once they have the first drink, even if they're not drunk, alcohol could impair their judgment, and they could have a second, a third, a fourth. I'm not saying that's responsible. Clearly, it's not. But at the same time, do we increase punishments against people who were asking to use their logical facilities at a time when they won't have them? I'm not sure how much sense that makes. It also relates, although admittedly somewhat tangentially, to the whole subject of crime and punishment outside the issue of being drunk. Many people who otherwise would agree with my general political philosophy, which, as you know if you've come to the show through the website, is liberal, progressive, call it what you will, and they agree with me on most issues. But I have this belief that hate crime legislation, forgive me, doesn't make a lot of sense. On the one hand, it doesn't make sense because of the fact that if I am a victim of your killing effort, if you kill me, I'm dead whether you are killing me because you just happen to be killing someone randomly, or you don't like me, or because of some because of my ethnicity, or your perception of my ethnicity, or because I'm straight or short or whatever. I mean, any one of those things doesn't make me any less dead or any more dead. But there's something that's more fundamental here. Many of the people who favor harsh penalties for hate crimes will be the first to tell you, as I would, that it's never been established that the death penalty acts as a deterrent to the commission of murder. If it's true that it doesn't, or at least arguable, that it doesn't affect those who might commit murder as a deterrent, and frankly that's difficult to prove either way, but let's assume that in fact it is not proven to be a deterrent at least, why would we believe that harsher penalties for hate crimes would act as a deterrent? Hate crimes are terrible, obviously, and if someone is acting against someone else because of their sexual identity, because of their religious identification or race or whatever, those are all horrible, and they should be and are, in fact, in our society, rightly condemned. But the whole concept of punishment for that being greater than just the standard crime is, I think, something that we have to examine more closely in terms of logic, my opinion. But most of what's on this show is my opinion, except for our interviews and calls that come in from you, if you choose to do that. There was a peek provided to the press today of a new computer operating system called Chrome. There already is a Chrome on the on the internet, and I'm trying to remember what it is. It's something else that you can use from Google. I know it's not a search engine. I don't remember what it is. The reason I don't is because I can't use it on my computer because I have an older operating system. That said, the operating system is going to be coming out, and Google has said that you won't be able to get a computer using it until next year. One of the advantages of using Chrome, similar to Linux, which is what's called an open system operating system, these would replace Windows if you're accustomed to using Windows. And in the case of Chrome, it's supposed to allow you to boot up, i.e. start your computer and be able to begin using it, within 7 seconds. Now, if you have a modern Windows computer, I will bet you a nickel you're not able to start work in 7 seconds after you turn your computer on. It usually takes substantially longer. Windows is what is called by many people who work with computers, who are geeks, as a memory hog. And that's basically what it is. So Chrome is designed to avoid, among other things, avoid that problem. Also, I believe from what I've read, it's going to be offered free, the effect of which is it will make the computers you buy, at least theoretically, more cheaply available. And speaking of cheap computers, there is a computer I saw advertised today at what's called a netbook, which is a very lightweight laptop or notebook computer. And it was being offered. It's got a gigabyte of memory. It's got a 160 gig hard drive and gigabyte hard drive. And it's selling for $289. What's really strange about that is back when the hottest computer around was what were called 386s, and if you remember that, you'll know how long ago that was. Back in those days when I worked at and managed a computer store, if someone came in, and the typical hard drive at that time was 20 or 30 megabytes, and we thought that, you know, how could you possibly fill 30 megabytes of hard drive? A gigabyte is about 1,000 times that the size of a megabyte. And I recently had the experience of having a 60 gigabyte hard drive on my computer being too full, and I had to change it out, but or add to it, I should say. But somebody came into the store and wanted to see if they could get a 60 megabyte computer, a 60 megabyte hard drive, rather, for their computer. And our wholesale price for that at the store, as buyers from a wholesale supplier, was approximately $300. Today, you can buy a very small laptop or netbook computer with a 160 gigabyte hard drive for under $300. It's at retail. It's amazing. But that's what's happening in the arena of tech. I wanted to bring you some what might be called weird news, and we'll do that in just a moment. But first, that cup of coffee feels great in your hands. The aroma goes right to your brain as you breathe it in. The cabin's warming up for the family because you had the foresight to get the fireplace going. And now the smell of that wood is mixing with your coffee. It took time and work to get to the point you could get up and go to your cabin whenever you wanted to. But it also took being smart. You were smart enough, for example, to know that if you're in business and have a website, you're really in business when you're also blogging. You went to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and chose Blog Wizardry to write your blogs for you. It was inexpensive, it was well done, and it increased traffic to your website and your company. Even though the cabin's getting nice and toasty, you can hear the wind blowing through the trees and get a sense of the brisk outside air. What was that noise? You go to the window. A doe and her fawn. It's going to be a good day. Blog Wizardry. Jeff on blogging.blogspot.com. And we're back. The website, weirdnews.com, that's weirdnews.com, is a website freely available to everyone, and these next two stories come from that website. Before we go to those, I want to remind you that in about 5 minutes or so, we're going to be joined by a guest, James Bailey, who's going to talk to us about his book called Bailey's Blood. And if you'd like to call in now to talk about anything we've discussed, or you want to call in when he joins us, the phone number is the same in both cases, 347-994-3796. Talking about news of the weird, here's a story out of China. A man whose name was Zhu, S-H-U, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but he's a 61-year-old retired teacher from the Jiangxi province. He let his curiosity, unfortunately, get the better of him when he was visiting a circus in Nankang. He put his hand through the bars of a tiger's cage to feel its fur. The tiger bit off four of his fingers. He collapsed, not the tiger, Mr. Zhu, collapsed on the spot as a result of shock, but he survived, and he received compensation from the circus equivalent to approximately $500 in American money. The tiger was unharmed by the incident, but indicated that next time perhaps he'd like some German food. Until that last part, it was all true. The British retailer, Debenhams, announced in September that it's going... I hate to do this story because it sounds so silly, and it frankly does sound made up. It said, the store said that they would begin selling men's underwear briefs whose opening is more accessible from the left side for left-handers. They've been forced for decades to manipulate a right-side opening. Previously said a Debenhams executive, left-handed men have to reach much further into their pants, performing a Z-shaped maneuver through two 180-degree angles before achieving the result that right-handed men perform with ease. Okay, one gets the feeling that this man has analyzed this problem far, far too much. We wanted to discuss with you briefly one element of the healthcare reform bills that are making their way through the Congress. The House has passed its version. The Senate is working on its. There are very many differences. If the Senate can get past the attempt at filibuster that will be undertaken and passes a bill, the different bills will then be put into a conference committee. Members of the Senate and the House will try to iron out the differences, and then the revised bill will be presented to both houses. And that bill, by the way, the revised conference committee bill, will not be subject to a filibuster. So all that really matters right now, if you like or are willing to accept the health care bills that are before Congress, is to get past the filibuster attempt that will be made. The Democrats in the Senate have said they're going to be bringing the bill to a floor vote, they hope, on Saturday. So that's when all of this action is going to take place. I expect C-SPAN's ratings will be higher than normal this weekend. Republicans have promised a holy war on the health care bill. In the remaining moment we have before we're joined by Jim Bailey, wanted to briefly mention to you that if you or someone you know has acne, this is nothing that I'm selling, nothing that I'm advertising, just some information, you can often stop the pimple in its tracks. And the way you do that is there's two different ways. One is with vitamin A, and the other way is with oregano oil. In both cases, you can get this in a health food store and in some cases drug stores. You buy the product, whether it's vitamin A or oregano oil. They come in what are often referred to as gelatinous capsules. There's those little round things that look like beads. And you take a knife, carefully, don't cut yourself, and you prick a hole in the gelatinous capsule. And then you squeeze out the liquid that's in there. It's disgusting. In the case of the vitamin A, it's greasy. In the case of the oregano oil, it's a little greasy and it's kind of sticky. But you then put it on the pimple. Now, if you can do this when you're just feeling the pain, I say you, because sometimes I've had this, and this stuff works great. It's very cheap. You can get it, as I say, in a drugstore or a vitamin store, and it works. You squeeze the juice out of either the vitamin A or the oregano oil, and you, if you can do this when you just are feeling the pain like a pimple is about to develop, and put it on there, and then do it several times during the day, you often can, number one, stop the pain, and number two, stop the pimple from developing before it does. If you have been plagued by this, when I was a teenager, I used to get a pimple about a pimple a month, and now I'm an adult, and I get it a little less often, but about every 2 months I'll begin to feel it. Put the, in my case, oregano oil on. It burns a little bit, but nothing serious, and it smells, as you might imagine, like you're trying to stuff a pizza onto your face. But it works, the pimples stop, and it's great. And so give it some thought, oregano oil or vitamin A. It could work for you. I believe we have either a caller or James Bailey, so let's see if he's available now. Jim, might that be you?
Yes, it sure is.
Okay, terrific. You never know, and when the call comes in, you can't always tell in terms of what the switchboard shows. We have with us James Bailey, who is the author of Bailey's Blood, Moonshine, Murder, and Wild Women, and it's a novel. For some reason, I thought it was a true story of your family. Is it a novel based on your family?
It's a fictionalization of the family that was my father's cousins and uncle, who lived in southeast Kentucky during the first part of the 20th century and killed a whole bunch of folks.
Okay. Well, tell us if you will. First off, thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about the story of your family, if you would, or your dad's family.
My family goes back to the 1600s in Virginia, and a group of them settled in Kentucky after the Whiskey Rebellion because they didn't think they should pay for the Revolutionary War by being taxed on their whiskey. And so they came to Kentucky.
That's a tax that was imposed during the administration of George Washington, right?
That's correct. Later on, George Washington was the largest producer of rye whiskey in the country. So.
Okay, well, there you go. Go ahead with your story. I'm sorry.
So they came to Kentucky, and they were very proud bunch. And this particular family, William and Martha Bailey, William was very, very proud and had an accident that knocked off both his kneecaps when he was young and was addicted to alcohol and morphine. And his wife, Martha, was very, very paranoid, died in a mental hospital. And along with their three sons, they just wreaked havoc around Knox, Clay, and Harlan County in Kentucky.
And they were involved in a lot of battles, you were indicating.
Yeah, they were fighting with the authorities all the time. And so one man told me that his pa said that they killed maybe 10 to 20 people. But a part of those killings were a feud with the White family, who were very rich and powerful in the neighboring county.
White was the family name.
Yes.
Right. And this was primarily over the subject of the alcohol production, that they had the problem with authorities who were trying to collect tax on it?
Well, a lot of the problem was surrounding alcohol, especially after Prohibition started. But no, it was just plain meanness, anger, fear, and so forth that drove these people to not count on the authorities to bring justice to their lives, but rather took it into their own hands.
And that basically is what occurred, what the book is about.
That's correct. I did some research and had 74 different newspaper articles, court records, oral histories, and so forth. And from that, I wrote a novel. So the motivation is best guess. The dialogue is clearly my own.
Right. And this was in the 1800s.
This from all 1907 began, to 1931.
I'm sorry, say that again?
From 1907 till
1931. Oh, 1907, 1931.
Yeah.
Okay. But you were talking about when they settled initially.
Well, they settled in 1796.
Okay.
In that country.
And that was 3 years before George Washington died, just to show off a little trivia knowledge. But for some reason, I don't know why I remember that. It's one of those strange things that happens with all of our minds. Certain strange things stick in them, and we can't get rid of them. So when did you undertake the writing of the novel?
When?
Yeah.
It started about 5 years ago. I retired early because I wanted another career. I was an engineering professor at Arizona State, and I wanted another career that would be very different. So I decided I was going to become a historian and a novelist, and began writing memoirs of my family's background and history, and ran into this one, which I had inklings of but knew none of the detail, and it was so fascinating that I thought it is a story that has to be told. It speaks to people who are involved in street gangs. It
mm-hmm.
speaks to racism and hatred of all kinds all over the world, and I personally believe that's a prominent factor of human existence.
How does the racism element fall into the story of your family? Or are you just talking about anger and hate and all of that?
Yeah, I believe that racism is caused by anger and fear
mm-hmm.
of the other guy. It falls into this category too. William, the father of the family, was clearly a racist, although his ancestors sided with the Union during the Civil War, but.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, he had a nephew who was renting a farm from William, and there was a large apple orchard on that farm. And this nephew was a religious guy, and the pastor told him that there was a black pastor in the neighborhood that really needed some help, and could he come over and pick some apples? He did, and William killed the black man, and the next day fired a shot to try to warn his nephew and killed him as well.
Wow. So he was not exactly what you would call a happy camper.
Well, he was certainly a disturbed individual, I'll say that.
Yeah, yeah.
He thought he should solve all his problems with a gun. They had three boys, Jim, Beverly, and John. Beverly was the oldest, John in the middle, and Jim was the youngest. He's the protagonist in my story. And their mother
mm-hmm.
gave them pistols when they were 12 years old and told them to carry them at all times to protect her.
Wow. When you were growing up, you in your family, you never heard any of these stories. These are things you pretty much discovered in your research. Is that right?
I heard inklings of stories, but my grandmother, my father's mother, would not mm-hmm. allow anybody to talk about them. So my father told me a few things, but no detail. He knew no detail. Although it turns out they moved from Kentucky to Amarillo, Texas, in about 1915 or 16 in order to get away from this feud, in order to get away from the family. Because they had
when you're saying they, you're talking about your dad's parents.
My grandparents, yes. They
right.
wanted to get away from the feud because they had older boys that could have gotten involved.
Right, amazing. Jim and I will continue talking, but if you would care to join us, if you have some questions for him, the phone number is 347-994-3796. And should you call, we'll try to get you right on. After you began the research and you discovered that, you said you had written, you'd started out writing memoirs. Did any of those get published, or was that just an act of artistic beginning, if you will?
The latter. It was an act. I wanted to write mm-hmm. things for my grandchildren and so forth, but I found this story so fascinating that I started taking courses in novel writing.
That's great. Did you retain all of the memoir activities that you did so that, in fact, that can be passed down eventually to your grandchildren and great-grandchildren?
Yes, it did, and I did a lot of research into the genealogy of the family that goes way back, and I wrote a book that contained all the genealogy of the Baileys of Southeast Kentucky, as well as all the factual evidence that is behind this particular novel.
That's great. So I assume that was not published. That's just something you've retained for your family.
No, the latter was published. The memoir I did not publish.
No, I meant the memoir, and I understand the novel was published.
As was another book called The Baileys of Southeast Kentucky, which is behind this book.
I see. And now, in terms of the publishing history and process, when was Bailey's Blood actually published?
Earlier this year, probably about September. I started about 8 or 9 months ago to look at the web, to look at alternative publishers, and I found some print-on-demand publishers that appealed to me, and they had good references on the web, and they weren't overly expensive. So I contacted them, they reviewed the book, and decided to publish it.
Go forward. That's great. While we're talking about that, and so I don't forget to do it, let's talk about how someone would obtain the book if they wanted to do that. Is it available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon. It's available through Kindle, through Ingram, at all bookstores. It's also available through the publisher. Let me see. I've got that written down here. I thought you'd ask it. It's
go ahead.
http://www.llumina.com/store/Bailey's Blood HTM.
Okay, very good. And before we leave each other a little bit later, I'd like you to mention that again in case someone didn't get it. And if you are listening and would like to get that again, you might want to have a pen available so that you can grab the website so you can access the book. But you can also access it, as Jim was saying, at Amazon. Now, you said it was also available at most bookstores, but you'd probably have to order it. Is that correct, rather than them stocking it?
Yeah, and if they would email me at my my address, I will send them a signed copy. My address is
jbailey
at asu.edu.
Okay. And that's j.bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, at asu.edu. Okay.
That's correct.
And so you have just returned, I know, from a bit of a tour, which I assume was related to the publication and marketing of your book.
Yes, I was just in Frankfort, which is the capital of Kentucky, and at the Kentucky State Book Fair, and did a signing there. And then I went down to Barberville, where most of the action takes place, and did a signing down there and met a lot of folks who knew more stories and were rattling them off to me.
Okay. Now, I was going to ask you about that. When you were in the area, not Frankfort, but you said Barberville. When you were there, were a lot of the folks who were there, I mean, are any of those folks your relatives still there?
None of my relatives are still there, but there are characters in the book whose great-grand children were there. And I have also met with the relatives of the White family and have talked with them. So I've met quite a few people who had close information about all these events.
Great. Nobody wanted to revive the feud, I hope.
No, but one of my relatives said he sat in the back of the room with a gun in his pocket just in case.
Just in case. You know, you never know. That's
he
funny.
He told me that afterwards.
Yeah, I understand. But in the meantime, how did it go in terms of the tour? Besides the folks who talked to you in the area, was there a lot of interest in the family history and in the novel at either the book fair or in any of the other signings? Tell us what the experience of the tour
was
like.
There was a lot of interest both places. I sold about 50 books, which I'm told is pretty good. And
yeah.
People in Kentucky are very interested in Kentucky history, and
sure.
People in Southeast Kentucky are very interested in feuding and, you know, shenanigans that went on down there.
My memory is flawed on this, so you can fill us in. Isn't that the broad general area where the Hatfield-McCoy thing took place? I don't know if it was in Kentucky as such, but wasn't it in the
yeah.
southeastern part of the country?
Yes, there's a short area there in Appalachia where West Virginia, Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky all come together. And
right.
all the feuds, pretty much all the feuds that are known in history were occurred there. The Hatfield-McCoy was on the border between West Virginia and Virginia. The biggest
mm-hmm.
feud in terms of length of time was the White-Baker feud, the same White family. It started in about 1810, 1820, and lasted until 1927 when the
wow.
action with the Bailey family finally ended.
Amazing. What for? Let me. I was going to ask you about what you think gives rise to these things. But before that, what caused these feuds to end? I mean, one obvious answer is everybody was dead. But I mean, what else? Is there something else that both the both of the White feuds to end in 27 particularly?
That
you know of?
They typically ended in some sort of a violent act. The
mm-hmm.
the Bailey White feud ended when. The White family finally killed Beverly Bailey, who had at the beginning of the feud killed Letcher and Perry White. So they finally
mm-hmm.
got him. And then most of the Bailey family moved from Knox County to Harlan County. And a couple of 3 years later, Bill Bailey killed his nephew, Ramsey Smith, and the Smiths were out to get him, so he skipped town and went to Harlan County, too. So they sort of end on violent events that causes one family or the other to sort of surrender and move away.
Yeah, I was going to say, or for one side to claim victory and stop.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah. And then we get to the question that had initially occurred, which is, based on your research and what you have determined from the process of writing this book, do you have an opinion on what gives rise to these things? I mean, what is it about that area, or what is it in general? I mean, obviously, what gives rise to it in reality is people hating each other, which is, you know, kind of like the surface-level answer. But do you have any other insights?
I think
insights?
It's much deeper. It's much deeper. There's historical reasons. I mentioned that the families moved to that neighborhood because they were trying to escape the federal government. They were trying to escape authority, and they were
mm-hmm.
they were, you know, out in the boonies anyway, and so they just moved from Virginia and Pennsylvania into North Carolina, back further into Tennessee, Kentucky, and so forth.
Right.
There's always been an independent streak there that they're a part of the country, but don't tread on me. And
right.
that had a lot to do with it. Also, in Kentucky was a border state during the Civil War, and so one family in one holler sided with the Confederacy, and the next family in the next holler sided with the Union. And so whenever a troop of either side came into town, they were told to go over to the next holler and burn that bunch out. And I think that caused them to sort of to trust only in themselves and only in their kin and not in their neighbors. In addition, there's a lot of, although I think this was all over the country at that time, there was a lot of shenanigans going on in the legal system. Believe it or not, the sheriffs and the judges were hired hands back then, and whoever was the wealthiest person in the county could literally hire the sheriff
wow.
in the county. So he got his own interest taken care of at the expense of other people, and nobody trusted the government. So I think that had a lot to do with it, but there's a religious thread through this, and that is that people who hate, they cannot live out people who are brave, they cannot reach out to somebody else. I'm messing this all up. People who are proud cannot reach out to other people and love them in a biblical way.
Mm-hmm.
They can't be kind to them because they're too proud to be that. And people who are afraid, they cannot ever forgive. Anything that happens, they can't forgive, because if you come and you punch me or you insult me and I don't hit you back or insult you back, then you're just going to do it again. So I think pride...
You'll think I'm weak.
Right, you'll think I'm weak. And that comes out clear in this book. If I am proud of who I am and afraid of who you are, you're going to have a fight. And I think if you look at street gangs and East L.A. and so forth, that's what the problem is.
Right.
You know, you live across the street, and I'm proud of the people who live on this side of the street and afraid of the people over there. So, also the Israelis and the Palestinians and a lot of things going on around the world are based on this pride and fear.
And there's territory and there's religion and all the rest in some cases. Yeah.
That's correct. You defend your territory and you defend your religion. And so that comes into it. Usually all the feuds that I read about, and I read about a half a dozen or so, they all start with some incident that should not have caused any kind of a problem, but because of the attitudes of the two groups involved, they blew it into a feud.
And you pointed out, you know, the fact is that when you don't trust government, or B, there is no effective government because someone has bought it, you then are more likely to take the situation into your own hands and try to achieve rough justice on your own.
Right, that's correct.
And you see that, by the way. It's not just clearly the examples you gave, which are obviously good ones, but Russia comes to mind today.
Yeah.
There is no really strong court system or enforcement mechanism for contracts. So you have people bribing and robbing and jailing and doing things to their adversaries because nobody trusts government. Nobody trusts government as the arbiter. So they do all that. That's why there is a Russian mafia besides greed.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Whenever you can't count on the government to give you a fair shake, you go get it yourself.
Yeah, if you can.
If you can.
That and then you have what might be called social Darwinism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Survival of the biggest gun.
Yeah, that's right. How have you enjoyed the process, not of the writing? I assume you enjoyed the writing and the research based on the way you were talking about it, but how have you enjoyed the process of, I guess the best way of putting it is marketing the books, having the post-publication process?
Well, it's great fun. I have enjoyed it completely. However, I'll never be a financial success at it. I wrote it because I wanted to write it and I wanted people to read it, and the experience is why I retired early.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to have the fun of writing it and getting it published and marketing it and going to book signings and things of this nature. And I've done that. I'm going to one in Scottsdale next Monday. I'm going to one in Tucson in March. And it's just fun to meet those people.
Have that experience, yeah. We may as well tout those now. Do you know the dates you're going to do that and the locations if someone is in the area and wants to come get your book, buy your book,
Scottsdale,
and get it signed?
Scottsdale, it's next, I believe it's Monday. It's going to be Sunday and Monday, and there's a Scottsdale Street Fair in downtown Scottsdale, and I'm going to be there from 1 to 5.
That would be, for those people who are listening on in the archived version, since today we're broadcasting on the 19th, Sunday and Monday would be the 22nd and the 23rd of November.
This next Sunday and Monday.
Right, the 22nd and 23rd of November, and it's
That's
in Scottsdale, Arizona. For those of you, of course, who are in New York City, this is of no value whatsoever. Because, but who knows? You could end up out there, Jim.
If
some
one
point.
Is in New York, they can email me, and I'll give it all to them.
There you go. And so that's Scottsdale Street Fair coming up the 22nd and 23rd, and you said you're also going to Tucson.
Yes, the University
you know
of
that
Arizona.
Is.
That's March 13th, and that's all day, I believe, at the University
that's
of
my
Arizona.
Lovely bride's birthday, by the way.
Give her my best.
I will do that. And so that's going to be at the University of Arizona. Is there any special place on the campus for those who are there?
I have not heard what.
Don't know that yet?
No.
Okay. Well, and they can find out the answer to that by dropping you an email. You'll be able to have their email address and then email them when you know details, should they be interested in joining you in Tucson. And that would be, again, that's J.Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, at asu.edu. And by the way, I hadn't written that down. That's the sign of a reasonably good memory, I suppose. And what I don't have memorized, of course, is the website where people can obtain your book and get more information. So after the www, what comes next, Jim?
Let me just give you an email address that is everybody's good. Orders,
okay.
ORDERS, at LLUMINA.com.
Okay, and the website would be LLUMINA, one word, LLUMINA.com, correct?
That's correct. /store/ Bailey's Blood.
There you go. And Bailey's Blood in that instance would be one word, no apostrophe, correct?
That's correct.
All right. The book, again, is called Bailey's Blood, and it's... story of basically a feud that went on for a very long time and talks about the human dimension as well as somewhat fictionalized family history.
That's correct.
For those of you who are just joining us, yeah. With that, Jim, I'm going to let you go because we have a little bit more business to conduct on the show. But thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope people do go to the website and do drop you an email and pick up the book.
I sure do appreciate your help, sir.
Our great pleasure. I appreciate yours.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And thanks. And for anyone else who would like to join us to talk about the topics we've covered in the show so far, I'm going to ask you to wait until we bring you the endpoint essay, if there's time. Otherwise, you can join us next week. Next week, by the way, is Thanksgiving, but we're going to be on. So if you're busy on Thanksgiving, you can pull up the program in its archived edition by going to the same site you've gone to listen to the show, which is blogtalkradio.com/Jeff-Bushman. Without spelling out hyphen, please. It's just a dash. But next week on Thursday night, Thanksgiving, we're going to have as our guest my lovely bride, Alicia, who is an expert astrologer. And she's going to be talking about astrology, and we'll answer your questions should you wish to call in 2347-994-3796. That's next week. But now, let's talk about... let's go ahead and talk and discuss our endpoint essay. So let me present that to you, if I may. Let's first acknowledge the obvious. I'm a male, and a male talking about breast health and breast cancer is something like a woman talking about how easy and painless a process it is to get a vasectomy. While the latter is true, based on my experience, if a woman had told me before I had the procedure that that was the case, I'd have what could only be considered a cynical response. So it's understandable if anyone listening to what I have to say has a similar reaction. But what I'm going to say, I think, needs to be said. The government task force that came out yesterday with a report that advised women to not begin having mammograms until age 50 rather than 40, and then only every other year instead of every year, was right, if a bit understated. They also recommended that women not be taught to do breast self-examination. They were right, as it turns out, about that as well. Let's talk about a few popular misconceptions before that, let me talk about something else. Let's talk about credentials. I don't have any. I know how to read, however. Assuming you have that ability as well, let me recommend a book that might change your mind if you're thinking you disagree with me. It's called Worried Sick, and it's written by an MD who does have credentials. His name's Norton Hadler, H-A-D-L-E-R. It's frankly a little tough to get through, not because it's emotionally difficult, but because it's, I guess, what you would call intellectually dense. It's not to say I'm smart and you're not. That's not the case. But it is a book that's a little hard to get through because it's a lot of material. And it talks about a variety of things, including how we have a tendency to over-medicate and over-test. He speaks, that is, Hadler does, with some intensity about mammograms. The book came out a couple of years ago, and he beat this latest advisory panel to the punch. What's wrong with annual mammograms beginning at age 40 is that they're not very useful and they can be really harmful. Now, when your Aunt Sadie and my cousin Sue are among those folks whose breast cancer was found on a mammogram, that anecdotal evidence proves nothing except that we're glad for Sadie and Sue, assuming they lived long, happy lives afterwards and died in their sleep of something else decades later. Hadler and the panel reached the conclusion separately that a population of women having mammograms will create a situation where the false positives are much more common than false negatives or actual positives. What that means is that a lot of women have gone through a lot of stress and biopsies and expense for nothing. While catching breast cancer by a mammogram is valuable for the few, they are few indeed. And by catching, of course, I mean coming to the realization that it's there. There's another problem with mammograms as well. They use radiation. While the amount of radiation in one mammogram is small, it doesn't go away, and it accumulates in the bones. That can lead to osteoporosis, and worse, breast cancer itself. The panel also recommended against teaching women to do self-exams. The science there is also very sound. When tests were done to determine whether women who weren't taught how to perform the self-exam found lumps any less frequently than women who were instructed, there was no difference. Again, there were massively more false positives than actual ones. And as most physicians will tell you, if a woman feels a lump and it turns out to be cancer, that's not really early detection. At that point, the cancer has usually progressed pretty well, or more correctly, pretty badly. That doesn't mean it'll necessarily be fatal, but it doesn't mean success either. Also, it's as likely that a woman will notice more casually than during self-exams. Just when she's in the shower, she may notice a lump, just as we would notice a lump and think it odd if we found one in the back of our calves or on our face. We would notice it and we would go to a doctor. Now, I'm sorry if this upsets preconceptions, but facts are what they are, and women really are better off with fewer mammograms rather than more. That brings us to our end point. If you would care to if you'd care to join us next week to talk about what we just talked about in the essay, to talk about Jim Bailey's book, if by that time you've read it particularly, or anything we've discussed or could discuss in politics, economics, or next week in particular, astrology, please do join us. We have a couple of minutes remaining. I just wanted to talk very quickly, if I may, because I want to give you a prediction. The Oprah Winfrey show is supposed to be ending in 2011, and that's supposed to be announced formally in the next couple of days, I believe, by Oprah Winfrey on her show. My prediction is that what will be announced is not that she's never going to have a talk show again, but rather when the present show ends at the end of her current contract, she'll be going to a cable channel, and the show will continue there, but you'll, of course, have to have cable or satellite to get it. That's my prediction, and next week or sometime in the next couple of days, you'll know if I was right, and you can call me and tell me, congratulations, you were right, or, hey, you're a bum and an idiot. In our remaining 90 seconds, I wanted to invite you again to go to a couple of websites in my own self-interest. If we get cut off by the end of the show, please join us next week, same time, same station. The websites are petlane.com/bushman. And jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. And finally, my book, The Mobile Millionaire, can be reviewed, or you could read excerpts, at tinyurl.com/mobilemillionaire. I'd like to thank Jim Bailey and commend you to his book, Bailey's Blood. I want to thank our producer extraordinaire, Autumn Bushman, the cutest producer anyone's ever had, but I can say that without reservation because she's our chihuahua. And want to also thank Alicia for preparing the items necessary for the show to go forward. Hope you join us next week. And invite your friends to go to the website and hear tonight's show and any of the other shows in our series. We'll be back next week at 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern. Thanks. You have flattered us by joining us, and good night.
10 seconds.